KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. A big Netflix setback, Warner Brothers Discovery chief David Zaslav reveals himself, and a shocking, not shocking, end-of-year shakeup at Disney. Banter buddies Matt Bellamy and Lucas Shaw join me for our 2022 end-of-year mega banter. I'm here with not one but two banter buddies, Matt Bellamy, founding partner of Puck News, and Lucas Shaw, head of the entertainment team at Bloomberg. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hey, Kim.
So,
are you going to acknowledge that we're in person for the first time in 3 years?
Okay, I am acknowledging that we are in person for the first, it is true, for the first time in 3 years. That's kind of amazing, isn't it?
I look the same. I don't know about you guys, but...
Only I look better.
You clearly had something done.
Yeah. No. Okay. Now, we're going to just start out. Let's just talk about what may or may not be the story of the year. I was going to say Bob Iger, replacing Bob Chapek at Disney. But in our pre-banter, Matt Bellamy here decided to put the Netflix stock dive into the mix. So Matt, explain to me why.
So I think everything that has happened this year in entertainment traces back to the complete abandonment of the streaming economy by Wall Street. Bob Iger does not come back to the Walt Disney Company if the Disney stock is not where it is right now. All of it goes to this subscriber miss that Netflix had first in the first quarter and then especially in the second quarter, where they lost subscribers in the U.S. The stock market absolutely turned. Everybody hit the panic button. And all of the stories throughout the rest of the year are traceable back to that.
All right. We're going to get into some of the rest of the stories, but I'm going to let Lucas respond to that as a guy who probably is, I don't know. I am told by the Netflix people that you know Netflix, you get Netflix more than the rest of us. So do you agree with Matt's assessment?
I don't know how to feel about that comment, but
I'm not making it up. They literally said that to me.
I think Matt is right that it's Netflix mixed with the darkening macroeconomic picture. So you tie in the fact that a lot of people are concerned about the economy, fear of a recession, all of that. The entire market is down. That tends to weigh on kind of what are known as growth businesses more than anything else. And Netflix was valued like a growth business, like a lot of those other Silicon Valley companies. It was worth, from a market cap perspective, way more than its profit and its revenue would suggest.
Irrational exuberance, I think we call that.
I think as soon as Netflix kind of hit the skids after basically 8 or 9 years of just kind of uninterrupted strong performance, all these other companies that were replicating its model suffered from it. Now, I am probably less bearish or pessimistic about streaming than the two of you and think that a lot of what's being said to reposition these companies is largely rhetoric, because the fact is they don't have a lot of other options than to invest in streaming. But it was the biggest story of the year in media. And when you see a lot of the pieces right now about, you know, the dire straits that these different businesses in or workers complaining about not getting paid. Just earlier this week, we had shows that were ordered and then canceled because companies are looking for any way to save money.
Right. We are in tough times and we are going to have a further talk about the year ahead in the next episode. But let's roll back. I think chronologically, we have to start with David Zaslav and the final arrival of the new management at what had been Warner Media and is now Warner Brothers Discovery.
Being able to get on a train that's already moving, there's almost like 74 million subscribers. We have over 20 million subscribers. And so together, I think we're going to get on this train. We're going to take it for a ride.
So Warner Media had been run by Jason Kyler. Jason Kyler infamously put the entire 2021 Warner's film slate on the streamer, then nascent HBO Max, allegedly due to the pandemic. But a lot of people thought his real agenda was that he's the streamer guy, and that's where he thought the future lay. There was just a terrible mismanagement of Warner Media under the ownership of AT&T. I mean, the New York Times ran this big piece about, is this the worst business deal ever? There were things I would quibble with in that piece, but it was a bad deal. And then Zaslav came into town well before he actually sat in the official chair, met with everybody and their cousins, and just radiated his love for Hollywood. I love the old movies. I mean, he is a little bit still to, like a kid in a candy store. You know, I'm in Jack Warner's office and I got his old desk out of storage and it's beautiful. And so people were, I think, kind of hoping, because Warner has this special kind of legacy of excellence. Is this the salvation of Warner's? And then, Lucas, reality hit pretty hard.
Yeah, I mean, he was given in a lot of ways a gift because, as you say, people were so ready for there to be new leadership at Warner Brothers, new leadership at HBO, new leadership at Warner Media. And he frittered away his goodwill about as quickly and spectacularly as you can imagine, largely because of the debt that you talked about. I mean, he came in and his number one priority as a leader, I think his strength at Discovery and his strength here is he's going to manage to Wall Street and he's going to tell them what they wanted to hear. Wall Street wanted to see more financial responsibility, greater cuts. And he went about systematically undoing pretty much everything the previous leadership had done. So if they believed in putting movies on the internet, David Zaslav believed in putting movies in theaters. If they wanted to expand internationally, he didn't want to. If they didn't want to do a deal with Amazon, he wanted to do a deal with Amazon. And he's made a lot of enemies pretty quickly through his approach. And, you know, we'll see if he has a strategy beyond being fiscally responsible.
Yeah, he had previously, they didn't want to sell their stuff elsewhere, but now they are allowing others to buy their stuff and doing things like this deal with Amazon. But Matt, you know, the cancellation of Batgirl, an almost finished $90 million movie. I was talking to a head of another studio recently, and he's like, you can't do that. You just can't do that. If it's not good, it's not good. But you just have to tough it out and put it somewhere. But you cannot do that. And that wasn't the only thing they killed. And they're pulling stuff off the streaming service that's been there for a long time. Trouble ensued.
Yeah, the honeymoon lasted about a month, maybe. And if that, it's hard to believe this deal only closed in April. It feels like Zaslav's been there years just because he was out doing the Dog and Pony Show beforehand. But it's kind of amazing the goodwill that he's squandered in only a few months. And this is the thing. It wasn't like it was a secret. He said when he was coming in that he was going to cut $3 billion in spending and synergies and such. And he's been doing that. He's been firing people and consolidating and killing projects. But it was the way that he went about it that I think really underestimated how the creative community responds to these kinds of cuts. You can lay people off. You can get rid of scripted programming at the Turner Networks. You can do a lot of the things that he did. But when you screw around with finished creative projects like the Batgirl movie, that was a $90 million savings. I'm not sure. He may have lost more than that in the goodwill and the relationships that something like that engenders. I mean, it's 6 months later and we're still talking about it.
Can I ask you guys a question? I'm curious though. So we talked about Zaslav and how he did maybe some of the right things, but the wrong way. We talked about AT&T similarly did maybe some of the right things the wrong way. We're going to talk about Bob Chapek did some of the right things the wrong way. And I guess my question is, what is the right way of doing these things, right? Are some of these actions just going to be, they're probably going to be really unpopular regardless. Is there a comparison that one could make to someone making equally tough decisions, but not doing so in a way that alienates people? Or is it just inevitable that people are going to be mad because you're forcing change?
I think when you get into the creative product itself, when you're managing from a position of, you know what, it's better for us to take a tax write-off on your creative endeavor than it is to actually release your creative endeavor. Those are the kinds of messages that do pretty significant damage to the brands. Now, these are very resilient brands. And as we saw this past week with White Lotus, everyone still goes nuts over the latest HBO show. But it does do damage when you renew a show like Minx and then 6 months later say, you know what? We're actually going to not renew. We're going to unrenew
trust,
your show.
Right, the trust
and
problem.
It's totally their right to do that. But every time you do this, you take a little bit of a withdrawal out of the goodwill bank or the trust bank that you have in these brands. And at some point, you know, maybe Warner Brothers isn't Warner Brothers anymore. Maybe HBO isn't HBO anymore. And the whole value of this company and what Zaslav has spoken ad nauseum about is the power and value of these brands.
Let me say a few things on this. One, you know, when I think Bloomberg broke the news that this deal was going to happen, I talked to a bunch of people who had worked for David Zaslav, and the first story before he even showed up for that first lunch with somebody, he was clearly a very tough boss. That was the unanimous. I mean, I actually said to someone at the company, please thank him for firing so many people, because it wasn't that hard to find sources for this story. And then I would say, yes, there's another line that somebody said in a story I wrote, and I've forgotten who, but it was someone of note in the industry. He doesn't know what he doesn't know. And this is a very subtle town, like dealing in the creative community, as you were referencing, Matt. And he, I feel like, still doesn't understand, like, let me talk about hiring James Gunn to run DC. James Gunn is a director. Another director who's already in their world, like Matt Reeves, is not going to look at James Gunn as his boss. He sees him as a peer. Now, Zaslav is saying he is your boss, and I think there's going to be conflict, and we already are seeing DC is so laden with its past iterations that it's very, very difficult. But that delicate touch, which we saw with problems with Bob Chapek and the Scarlett Johansson, that delicate touch of how to navigate this community, I'd say that is going to be something he has yet to learn, if he ever does. And then he's got Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdy in there. And Mike DeLuca are both, you know, creative community friendly. They haven't really released their slate of what they're going to do yet. But I'm sure you guys, like me, we're all wondering, so how is that going to work out?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how that's going to play out with the different power players at Warner Brothers. But I would push back a little bit on the James Gunn thing, because what do you want them to do at DC? They needed someone that had credibility in that world. David Zaslav clearly wants DC to be more like Marvel. So you can't hire Kevin Feige. His number two apparently wasn't interested. So what do? You look at someone like James Gunn, who has had serious success in the Marvel universe, created the franchise with Guardians of the Galaxy, has, you know, different projects at both DC and Marvel. And you pair him with an adult in the room with Peter Safran, who can come in and be Matt Reeves' boss.
I'm not questioning the hire so much as I am. And yes, you're going to have to break eggs to make the DC omelet now, because there's so much that went before. I'm just saying, I'm not sure David Zaslav anticipates how tricky that will be to navigate.
Well, I think the key point that you made is that he, at least as someone who's reported on a lot of these sort of outsiders who come into the industry, is that he doesn't know what he doesn't know. The key to success, I think, is being able to delegate and let other people figure out how to make the shows. And he is someone who is kind of famous as a micromanager, also famous for not wanting to spend a lot of money. And those are two very dangerous traits when you're talking about a movie studio and a premium cable network. Because those are two businesses that used to being able to spend with relative impunity, and you just sort of figure it out. And if you're starting to go line by line, and why are we spending all this money on this awards campaign? Why are we spending all this money on this party? You know, why are we spending all this money on reshoots? These are things that if you're in the business for long enough, you figure out you kind of need to do, and you'll manage the cost somewhere. And it ends up being worth it if you deliver that huge hit that ends up paying for everything. I'm not saying this is what's going to happen, but it's a very dangerous recipe for him as the leader. Now, he has, for the most part, said the right things about HBO and leaving Casey Bloys, who runs programming there, alone. Warner Brothers studio is a little bit different, because I think people have seen the movie studio as already being beneath where it was. You know, you go back 10, 15 years, and I think most people would have identified Warner Brothers as the best studio in town, or if not the best, one of the best couple.
So. Mm-hmm.
And it has since surrendered that territory to, I'd say, probably Disney and Universal, and it wants to get back to where it was.
Coming up after the break, more Mega Banter. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. I'm talking with Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck, and Lucas Shaw, head of Bloomberg's entertainment team, for our 2022 Year in Review. Now, let us pivot to this Netflix large bump in the road, let's call it. I know I wrote a story that was not well received by Ted Sarandos.
You just don't understand their business like Lucas does.
Okay, you can be that way, man. And basically the gist of the story was that, you know, they had Cindy Holland had brought them these very buzzy shows, these curated seeming shows, starting with House of Cards and going on through The Queen's Gambit. All of the shows that we chattered about, like we did with White Lotus, those were Cindy Holland. And Ted fired her during the pandemic. And Bella Bajaria, who had been an NBC and CBS television exec, took over. And they pivoted to broader, and some people read, less interesting or worse or junkier shows. And really, there did come a point, it seemed to me, where just anecdotally, I knew more people who were churning out of Netflix, you know, regular people in the world saying, yeah, I don't want to pay for it anymore. And then they missed their target for the first time. And boom, Wall Street really punished them. Their stock dropped. I mean, you've stepped in there for me, Lucas, because I can't remember numbers.
So Netflix's stock is down almost 50% this year. But it's basically doubled its share price since summer, which was sort of when it was at its bottom, which means that it was down more than 70. I think it might have been down almost 80% at one point.
Yeah, I don't think those two things are related, though, because the content on Netflix has been objectively popular this year. If you look at the shows that Netflix has released, I believe it's something like, you know, 5 of their top 10 shows of all time have come out this year.
They've had some big ones.
Big ones. The Ryan Murphy deal finally bore fruit with the Dahmer
Although
show.
That came after this bump
it
in the
did.
Road.
They have this Wednesday show that's huge right now. They
also more recent. Yes, go
they
on.
They have Harry and Meghan, which is on right now. They had Stranger Things and the final season of Ozark this year. Those are massive shows that really delivered an audience. Yet the economics of Netflix are challenged because we're coming out of the pandemic. People are reassessing what their entertainment costs are. We're going into a recession. All of these macro things that Lucas was talking about are influencing Netflix as much as the content itself. And that's why we see the ad tier.
Well, they're also competing with five or six very well-funded services. Yeah, the problem at Netflix doesn't seem to be a programming problem. I mean, you mentioned the Cindy Holland kind of ouster. And that was another example, I think, of what people saw as sort of something that was just handled badly. You know, they basically, Ted's longtime lieutenant for almost 20 years was ousted with like a 1 or 2 sentence statement. Normally in Hollywood, what you'd have in those situations is this person gets set up with some lavish production deal and they all say nice things about each other, even if they're stabbing each other behind the scenes. And Ted in particular was pretty unsentimental about it. But in the transition, the programming is still finding an audience. It's not the audience it was. It's not the HBO audience anymore. But look, HBO is trying to get to the scale and audience Netflix has. So I think that the bigger issue for them is they've spent so long focused on one idea, which is let's sign up as many subscribers as possible in as many places as possible. And at a certain point, it was just hard to sustain the growth rate that they'd hit. They'd gotten too big in too many places. And so that's, as to Matt's point, that's why they have advertising. It's why they're cracking down on password sharing. It's why nobody would be surprised to see them build ancillary businesses. It's why they're investing in gaming. They just need to find sort of that other lever for growth. There's absolutely no guarantee that they'll find it, but they're on more solid footing considering the state of the media business than most of their peers.
And their streaming service is profitable. That's not something that any of these other companies can say, though it's their only business.
Well, it's their only business and they had quite a head start on everybody else. I think it's a little bit of a combo. I mean, the stuff you just cited, Matt, was all pretty recent. There was a drought there and Stranger Things was the thing that was really standing out. And that was a holdover from the Cindy era. You know, my question had been, why can't she make that kind of show side by side with the broader shows? And I think it really, if you really want to tell the truth, it boils down to she pushed back on things that Sarandos was doing, like chasing Oscars and clinging to Dave Chappelle. And I think he just got tired of being told an opinion like that. You know, he's gotten extremely rich. He's got a nice house in Montecito and he can invite, you know, Meghan and Harry over and all of that. And I just think he got tired of it and they lost an asset because he didn't want to hear it anymore. But is that just me?
No, well, the other, I think you're right that there is a certain tone deafness at the top of that company because they've been so successful and gotten so rich that there is perhaps less of a tolerance for dissent than there used to be. That being said, anytime I've put that to Ted, to Reed, to other people at the company, I've gotten, even people who have been critical of them, I've gotten some pushback about how there's still plenty of voices of dissent. The one thing I would say, though, on the programming front is they have also set up a model where they need to have a lot more hits than anyone else.
Yes, they both throw because, so much spaghetti at the wall.
Because of the binge model, their shows churn faster. So HBO can basically coast on White Lotus for like two and a half months. They need to have one or two other things, especially if they want to grow, but they don't need as much. And Netflix is just trying, you know, to your point, just putting out more. And so they can't only have three or four hits in a year. They need to have one, if not every week, like every other week, every month. And that's very hard to do.
And I will also say this, they're in this thing about movies for streaming. You know, I think they really annoyed the town with Gray Man, which was so expensive. And I heard more complaining from different people in this community.
Not from Ryan Gosling or not from any of the talent involved.
Not from people who got paid, but
the Russo brothers.
They were happy.
Those checks cash.
Yes, but it was something just irked this community, to put it mildly. Like, why are they spending what I heard was $200 million? They'll say it was less. And there are people now, you know, I think there's a pivot now. Why are we even making movies for streamers? They're not worth it.
Well, the audience was there for Gray Man. It was a hit for Netflix. So
well,
by their own metrics.
But
the funny thing is,
know.
There was a movie that came out right around the same time on Netflix called Purple Hearts, which cost nothing compared to Gray Man and was also putting up crazy good numbers on Netflix. And it's like, I know, you know, you want to be diversified and there are different audiences and you want people to perceive the value of your service, but why does Netflix feel like it needs the $200 million Ryan Gosling movie if it's not going to be good?
Or if they're only making money from it in one way. A movie like Purple Hearts, which costs a fraction, that's fine to have it as essentially a streaming and at-home movie. But if you're going to try to compete at the epic scale of movies that go in theaters, there's a reason those movies go in theaters, because it allows the company to try to make money from them in multiple windows. Netflix has only got the one. So
wait, are you suggesting that Netflix should put movies in theaters for longer?
No, you're reversing that into something else. We've discussed this before. I think there's some logic to it, but Netflix would need to scale up that type of movie and also make them better. I mean,
I think there's just a change in the town. Like David Zaslav has said, we're not making movies for streamers. MGM claims they're spending, Amazon says they're going to spend $1 billion, another Bloomberg story, Lucas, points
but
to your team.
The Zaslav, we're not going to make movies for streaming, to me, makes no sense. That only makes sense if you're only going to make the huge theatrical movies. What have we seen time and time again over this year, with the exception of like maybe Everything Everywhere All at Once and like a couple of other movies? Nothing that is kind of a mid-budget movie is getting people into the
theaters. I'm just going to say the one word, smile.
Yeah, the horror movies.
The horror is the other exception.
Okay.
But they're all these comedies, dramas, whatever.
Yes,
they make sense for streaming. Comedies are not working theatrically right now. I'd love them to. I love comedies. But if you're going to try to make a $35 million comedy, it wouldn't be the worst thing to just drop it on streaming.
I'm saying that I think the studios, other than Netflix for obvious reasons, are going to try to put the genie back in the bottle and get theatrical to work again. And what they are saying to me is, we're going to make more movies and people are going to get back in the habit and... We'll see.
But that assumes that the business can dictate the customer.
Yes.
And over and over again, the customer tends to dictate the business.
That's true. Will people rediscover movies? Now, with that, we will turn to Bob Chapek and Bob Iger, the double Bobs at Disney.
The strategies that Bob's put in place are really, you know, long-lasting in terms of where the company's going to go in the short term. Over time, though, as we all both recognize, disruption and transformation are just inevitable in this business.
I will just say briefly, who doesn't know this at this point? Bob Iger, I think, very reluctantly retired at the end of 2021. It was clear to the world that he thought very little of Bob Chapek. I mean, people always refer to him as his hand-picked successor. I think really what happened there is the board was, as they should have done, they were leaning on Bob Iger to pick a successor and do something about succession. He was 70 years old. And I think he just got to this point of saying, fine, okay, fine. If you want that so badly, why don't you have this guy, who, by the way, is the only one in the building or in extended buildings who can even be colorable as a CEO.
Do you think that Iger, when he picked Chapek, had it in his mind, either consciously or unconsciously, this is going to go poorly and they're going to need to come back to me?
I think that he thought this is going to go poorly and he would not mind that very much.
He certainly acted that way around town from almost the very beginning.
You don't buy the theory, because a lot of folks told me that Iger assumed that Chapek was the kind of person who would just continue what he had done, right? He had no vision. He was just an operator. And so the company would be fine because Chapek would follow Iger's playbook, and Iger trusted in his own playbook so much that he thought
If he ever thought that, it was apparent before he left the premises, because Chapek immediately, and I think not smartly, shunted him aside when he was still there as the emeritus chairman, whatever, you know, trying to be involved in creative. I think probably, I mean, I'm willing to believe that Bob Iger's ego is big enough to think that JPEG wouldn't dare do that to him, but he definitely dared.
But let's be fair. I'm not a JPEG apologist here, but something big in the world happened the moment that JPEG took over and Disney had to deal with the pandemic. I mean, it wasn't like this was a continuation of everything Iger did, just honky-dory.
If you want to be really cynical, you could say he stepped out of the way of the oncoming train, well, and then when the train passed, he stepped back on the train.
Clearly, he knew what was coming when he stepped down,
yes, obviously.
But I think JPEG was dealt a pretty bad hand, but he made it worse.
Yeah, the litany, I mean, I almost feel like it's like I memorized the Scarlett Johansson fight, the big battle over Don't Say Gay, you know, which he just had to do a complete 180, you know, and take a position. And then Ron DeSantis went after him, all of that. And then it became this issue of, you know, these giant losses in streaming. I mean, I'm actually hearing almost like Zapruder film analyses and rumors and gossip about what really caused this super abrupt, like, Bob Chapek, you want to talk about an unceremonious dismissal? You're out. Like, not even a goodbye memo to the staff.
He was supposed to introduce Elton John on stage,
that night.
He just didn't show up.
Yes, didn't show up. And his lieutenant, Kareem Daniel, gone the next day. And Kareem Daniel had been part of this reorganization, putting a lot of power in his hands and away from the creative executives that was resented. And the firing of Peter Rice, a very respected executive. I mean, there were all these things.
What do you think, if you had to name the best thing that JPEG did as CEO, what would you pick?
Oh my gosh, what a lens. I haven't even thought about it. Give me a minute. I, you know, we're so not used to thinking of it that way. I don't know, because honestly, Lucas, the fans were mad too. They were like, they called him all kinds of names and they said the parks weren't in great shape.
But the shareholders loved that. I mean, he was literally price gouging at the parks and the shareholders loved that because it gave them
brand damage, right?
True. You could argue. I mean, I have argued that many, many times, but at least in the short term, they did get a boost there.
Lucas is going to tell us the best thing.
I don't know that I have. The one thing that came to mind, but I'll then argue against myself immediately afterwards, is that he did embrace a shorter window for movies. Disney adopted sort of a flexible approach to releasing movies during the pandemic, which Scarlett Johansson debacle aside was actually quite smart and effective.
And necessary.
See, I would disagree on that.
The counter argument to that is because the kids' movies were now available at home so quickly,
and
he's
I've been
killed
hearing
his
a lot
theatrical
of that.
Business.
People are furious with
that. The long-term damage of putting the Disney animated movies on streaming is yet to be told, because I think families have become accustomed to that. It completely cheapened an entire genre of movies. When you think Disney movies now as a family, you think, oh, that's going to be on Disney Plus. Maybe not today, but probably in a couple weeks. So we're not going to go out and see that.
So the slate pitch on this would be the Encanto success story was actually the worst thing that could have ever happened to Disney.
Well, I will note, you know, I asked Chapek during his brief tenure, you know, can a movie succeed the way you need it to succeed with all your theme parks and your ships and your this and your that if it's on streaming only? And he said, yes. And I said, what is the example? He said Encanto. Now, Encanto was in theaters. It didn't perform that well. But I know many people who believe that without a theatrical platform and marketing campaign, movies don't land the same way. And
I
think we've
seen
proof of that.
It would never have done what it did if it didn't have that boost.
Tell him.
But my best JPEG thing, the beard.
Oh, you like the beard?
The beard was excellent.
Okay. I think the beard was sort of an unintentional decision, but he then sort
unintentional.
Of stuck with it.
That's a choice.
Well, let me just say, however much trouble we're having thinking of the best thing Chapek did, we will note that following Bob Iger is a very tough act. He's one of the most admired people.
And especially when he's out there trashing you to the community while you're in the job.
And doesn't really leave for the... Because I was reminded of it when we had to do reporting around his return. Iger didn't actually leave until the end of 2021. So Chapek was by himself in that job for 9-10 months. And within 2 months, he had the Florida situation.
Yeah, what a mess. Well, that is where we're going to leave our banter. That has been Lucas Shaw, head of the entertainment team at Bloomberg, and Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Thank you guys both so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from John Meek and Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week. on the business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.